This is History's Hidden Killers. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Karen Sparks, 18 years old. She is asleep in her basement bedroom in a house on the University of Washington campus. It is January 4th of 1974, and sometime before dawn, somebody comes in through a side door that wasn't locked, pulls a metal rod off the frame of her own bed, and beats her with it while she sleeps. And by the time her roommate finds her, she is unconscious, and she is going to stay that way for 10 days. When she wakes up, she has lost most of who she used to be. Brain damage will live with her for the rest of her life. Memories that don't come back. The independence she had as an 18-year-old college student gone in a single night. By the hand of a man whose face she will never see. Karen Sparks survives. She is the first one that we know about. Her case goes into a stack on a Seattle desk. There's no suspect. There's no pattern yet. There is a girl who almost died in her own bed and a city that has not yet learned to be afraid. 4 weeks later, the same city does it again. Girl doesn't come down for breakfast. Her name is Lydia Healy. She's 21 years old, a University of Washington senior, a psychology major, and she reads the morning ski report for a local radio station, the kind of voice that wakes you up. She lives in a greenhouse in the university district with four other women. The night of January 31st, 1974, she eats dinner with her roommates, runs to the grocery store, has a beer at a nearby tavern, comes back, talks for a few minutes with the roommate in the kitchen, and goes downstairs to her room. The next morning, when she doesn't show up for her shift, her boss calls the house. Her roommate goes down to the basement. Her bed is neatly made. Lydia never made her bed. The pink satin flower pillowcase is gone. There's a small spot of blood on the pillow under the cover and another small spot on the wall. Her nightgown is hanging in the closet neatly with blood at the neck of it. Her bike is still there. Her purse is still there. Her clothes are still there. She is the thing missing. This is the whole tone of what Seattle is about to walk into. Not gore, not a scream in the night, something quieter. Somebody bothered to make the bed. This, right here, what we're about to get into, is our first conversation in our five-part series, Ted Bundy, History's Hidden Killers. Every couple of weeks, we're going to do a new series on one of history's hidden killers, a five-part series, and focus on what went on in these historical cases, and what does time tell us now? I invite you to weigh in with your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Those links are in our description to continue the conversation as we work our way through all of this. On this one, Ted Bundy, History's Hidden Killers. It's about the first year right now. Because none of what comes after makes sense without it. So let's get into that and kind of set the frame, if you will, for the Bundy story. The year goes like this. March 12th, Donna Manson, 19, walks out of her dorm at Evergreen State in Olympia, heading for a jazz concert, never gets there. Her body has never been found. April 17th, Susan Rancourt, 18, leaves a study group at Central Washington in Ellisburg, walks back towards her dorm. Witnesses later remember a clean-cut young man on crutches asking her to help carry books to his Volkswagen. May 6th, Roberta Parks, who goes by Kathy, 22, walks across the Oregon State campus in Corvallis to meet friends for coffee. This is the first time he crosses the state line. The Oregon case will not be tied to the Washington case for months. On June 1st, Brenda Ball, 22, leaves the Flame Tavern in Bern, last seen talking to a young man with his arm in a sling who was looking for a ride home. June 11th, Georgian Hawkins, 18, walks from her boyfriend's dorm back to the parking lot behind her sorority, maybe a block. Her friends are at the window waiting for her. A witness remembers a young man on crutches this time, asking for help carrying a briefcase. Georgian is gone inside that block. By June, the King County detectives can see the shape of it. Same age range every time, same long dark hair, parted in the middle every time. Same helpful young man who needs a hand carrying something to his car. The Seattle papers start to use the word pattern. Mothers in the university district start sitting on their porches at night, waiting for their daughters' headlights. I think it's worse. In broad daylight, in front of 40,000 people, July 14th, 1974, Lake Sammamish State Park, 20 miles east of Seattle. A Sunday so hot, the lake is wall-to-wall families. Janice Ott, 23, last seen on the beach helping a handsome young man with his arm in a sling load a sailboat onto his tan VW. Told her his name was Ted. 4 hours later, the same park, the same afternoon, Denise Naslin, 19, walks towards the bathrooms and never comes back. He took two women in one afternoon in daylight in a public park in front of 40,000 witnesses. And several of those witnesses heard him use a name. That sentence there should be impossible. The lake in July is one of the busiest state parks in Washington. Families everywhere, lifeguards, park rangers, 40,000 people on a single afternoon. The man with the sling wrapped up, walking over to women in the middle of all that, said his name out loud and walked away with them twice in 4 hours. Nobody intervened. Nobody followed him to the parking lot. Nobody noticed in the moment that he had taken anybody at all. Just another guy. Another Ted. What the witnesses also remembered when investigators went back to the lake in the weeks after was that the handsome young man with his arm in a sling had been working the beach the whole afternoon. By some accounts, he approached at least four other young women before Janice Ott helped him. Three of them said no, busy, sorry. One of them said her boyfriend was right there. They went home that night and read about Ott and Naslund in the paper the next morning. They realized slowly that they had walked away from somebody. They lived with that realization for the rest of their lives. Now, King County has a description, a car, a first name at this point, a composite goes on the front page. The tip line opens. Who is, what's going on here? People are freaking out. The tips come in. They come in fast. They come in by the thousand. By some accounts, the King County Ted Task Force eventually accumulates somewhere past 200,000 names, among them Elizabeth Knopfler, his own girlfriend, who reportedly calls in her own boyfriend, Ann Rule, who reportedly calls in her crisis line coworker, a psychology professor at UW, who reportedly calls in his own student. The name Ted Bundy on three separate cards in three separate stacks. Tan VW, right age, right description. And nothing happens. Not because the detectives were lazy, not because Bob Keppel and the King County Task Force weren't working, because there were too many tips, too many Teds, too many tan VWs in a city that loved them. And because the picture every single human being in that building was carrying in their head of the kind of man who could do this did not match a cleanly cut law student volunteering on political campaigns. The right name was in the stack. Nobody pulled it. The task force eventually did what task force in 1974 did when they were drowning. They went to a computer. The University of Washington ran a cross-reference program for them, looking at the tips, looking at the suspect lists, looking at the names that came up on more than one. The program kicked back a top 100. Bundy was on it. The task force then ranked the top 100 by priority. Bundy got filtered down. He had no record. He had a clean apartment. He was a law student. He didn't match the picture. The program could not, no matter how many times they ran it. Then, on September 6, 1974, two grouse hunters near a service road outside a town of Issaquah find skeletal remains in the woods. They call it in. The search teams find Janice Ott. They find Denise Naslund. They find more bones than two bodies can account for. There's at least one other person on the site. The Issaquah dump ground is, in the cold language of policing, multi-use. The man who took these women has done this enough times to have a place. This is the day Seattle stops calling them missing. The families now know. Janice Ott's parents now know. Denise Naslund's mother now knows. The other names, Linda's family, Donna's, Susan's, Kathy's, Brenda's, Georgian's, are all waiting. They'll wait through the fall, through the winter. Some of them will get phone calls the following March when two forestry students surveying Taylor Mountain mark a tree and find a skull on the ground next to it. They'll mark another. They'll find another. Four skulls on one mountain. The next chapter of the story will start with those phone calls and the families on the other end of them. Donna Manson's parents never got that call. They never got that call because there's never been a body to identify. And there still isn't. By some accounts, her mother set a place for her at the dinner table for years. But in late summer of 1974, all of that could change. All of that's still ahead. And the killings in Seattle just stopped. The papers noted the community half relaxes the way a person who's been holding their breath finally exhales. Not because anything has changed, but because they can't hold it together any longer. Mothers start sitting in their living rooms again. The university district starts walking home at night. People want to believe they survived something, that whatever it was, it's over. It isn't over. Ted Bundy is packed his VW Beetle and started driving east. He's enrolled at the University of Utah College of Law in Salt Lake City. He has a new apartment lined up at a rooming house on First Avenue. He has new neighbors who have never heard of him. He has new plates coming. He has every reason to start over because nobody east of the Cascades knows what he did in Washington. And nobody in his new building has any idea who is unpacking boxes on the second floor. The drive from Seattle to Salt Lake takes about 12 hours. He did it in his Beetle. By his own later accounts, he stopped along the way, slept in his car at a rest area, finished the trip into Utah in his own pace. The Monday morning, he registered for classes at the University of Utah Law School. The state of Utah had no reason on earth to look at him twice. He was, by every measure that the state had used to assess people, a clean slate. He intended to keep it that way. The Washington file does not go with him. There is no shared database in 1974 that can light up in Utah when a name in Salt Lake and a patrol car matches a name in the King County stack. There is the U.S. Postal Service and the telephone and the careful goodwill of one detective calling another. And that is it. He is, the day he crosses the state line, completely anonymous again. There are at least seven women, seven that we know of, who are gone or dead or in a coma caused by him by the time the moving truck pulls into Salt Lake. Karen Sparks, who lived. Linda Healy, who read the ski report. Donna Manson, who was going to a concert. Susan Raincourt, who was walking to her dorm. Kathy Parks, who was meeting friends for coffee. Brenda Ball, who needed a ride home. And George and Hawkins, 11 steps from her sorority's back door. Janice Ott, who helped a polite stranger with his sailboat. Denise Naslund, who went to the bathroom. That is who they were before any of this had a name attached to it. They were not characters in a story. They were people with their own, with Februaries and ski reports and concerts and coffee and steps left to walk home. He was hidden in that first year. And the answer is small, and it costs everything to find out who he is. He was hidden because nobody had figured out yet that there was one man to hunt. By the time anyone did, the man was in a different state. And his head start was going to outlast some of the families that paid for it. What he did in Utah, and what almost nobody in Utah knew yet, is the next room. That's coming up next, as we continue diving into the world of Ted Bundy. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Press subscribe, and we'll continue our conversation there.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now, and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.